Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The formal certification of the Electoral College by Congress is normally a matter of ceremony. Not this year, not today. Texas Republican Congressman Brian Babin is among more than 100 House GOP members and 13 Republican senators planning to challenge the results today. In an interview last month, he said that he and others were left with no other choice.
Over and over again, the president's team has tried to get their day in court. Over and over again, we're being pushed back, even by Republican judges. It's incredible. And so we think that instead of getting our day in court, we're going to get our day in Congress.
Joe Biden last month said that the courts have spoken.
They're heard by more than 80 judges across this country. And in every case, no cause or evidence was found to reverse or question or dispute the results.
Natalie Jennings is the editor of The Fix, the Washington Post blog that analyzes and explains the biggest political stories of the day, and the 5-Minute Fix newsletter. Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the Georgia runoff races and how that plays into today's certification process. Democrat Raphael Warnock has been declared the winner by the Associated Press against GOP Senator Kelly Loeffler. Republican David Perdue is trailing against Democrat John Ossoff. Will the looming power shift in the Senate play any role today?
Not a practical one. The tally of the Senate and the Senate majority still is exactly what it was yesterday, as the Ossoff race, Ossoff-Perdue race has not been called. Mitch McConnell is still the majority leader. And prior to the Georgia races, there were enough Republican senators that any threat to Joe Biden's presidency was not going to be really, you know, the outcome of today was not in challenge before this race. What it does is sort of deflate. And it also, you know, you wonder about the political ramifications for people who are doing something out of loyalty to President Trump or because they think that will be politically beneficial. There's a lot of question today about what President Trump's influence is going to be. They couldn't pull out these races in a red state. And do people respond accordingly? Are the objections a little more tempered, knowing the political reality that the Senate is going into?
President Trump has pressured Vice President Mike Pence, who as Senate president technically oversees or presides over the proceedings. The New York Times on Tuesday reported that Pence has told the president he cannot block certification. Trump disputes that report. What is Pence's role here?
It is, as you said, pretty ceremonial. He's to preside over things. He can recognize members who have objections, but he doesn't have any role in counting. There's not a tie here, which is when he actually gets a vote. So it's kind of wishful thinking. And the law is pretty unambiguous that Pence has no recourse here. Anything he does risks putting him, in legal jeopardy, you know, facing lawsuits or some such. So Pence's lose-lose situation here is to either really disappoint his boss by not taking some sort of stand, whatever he can figure out within the confines of his limited role, or to do something that is very clearly outside the bounds of the law. We know that, you know, boundaries and things have not really mattered to President Trump. He doesn't see the rules of applying to him. That is not necessarily the case with Vice President Pence, and now these two ethics clash in the most epic way we've seen throughout this presidency.
Has President Trump cited anything specific explaining why he thinks the vice president has this power?
Not super specific. He says he has, you know, it's very clear and that, you know, the law allows and that Pence has a role here, but he's not being specific. And again, the law would dissuade anyone from thinking that. It's desperation. And we know that the realities of the law have not really confined President Trump's thinking on this. We heard more evidence of that over the weekend in the tape obtained by the Washington Post, where President Trump was pushing the Georgia Secretary of State to do something, even though multiple legal challenges have borne out the results of the presidential race. It just is sort of akin to what President Trump is trying to do here, not letting the reality get in the way of what he wants to happen.
Today is the day they certify the results of the Electoral College in 50 states. It's a joint session of Congress is convened to do this. My guest is Natalie Jennings. She's editor of The Fix. That's the Washington Post blog that analyzes and explains the biggest political stories of the day and the 5-Minute Fix newsletter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're kind of focused on the here and now right now with Natalie. We'll have political scientists and historians on later in the show if you have history questions. Trump is scheduled to speak at 11 a.m., which is about 2 hours before the Senate joint session, I think, convenes. What are the expectations of what he's going to say?
Well, President Trump is on his way out of office. He's got about 2 weeks left. We know that he loves a crowd that loves him, and he is looking for some validation. And by all anecdotal accounts and accounts from my colleagues who are out reporting, the crowd is very dense. We've had several of these pro-Trump rallies in D.C. the last few weeks, but this one appears to be far greater in volume than anything we've seen. Tensions are pretty high here about that. But for President Trump, this is the people that he wants to see, the people that will give him validation. You know, he tends to listen to people who tell him what he wants to hear. He tends to watch media that tells him what he wants to hear. And now he's going to see his base. So we expect to hear him, certainly not cop to what is going to be going on in the Senate, which is a drawn out process for, you know, his loss being officially made official there. Mm-hmm. We expect him to further energize those people who love him so much that they have traveled from all around the country to be here. Anybody who's flown in from Washington in the last few days has said planes are full of these people who are coming in to support him. So that will maybe boost his spirits on a day when he is facing the fact that the Georgia Senate races both probably didn't go his way, and mm-hmm. that the Congress is going to validate his loss.
The timeline of the process today, usually it's, as you mentioned, it's ceremonial, it's perfunctory, really. Not so today. If these objections to the different votes in the different, in particular states, go forward.
That's right. Congress will meet at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and then start going through the states. They've taken some precautions so that there's just kind of a representative sample of the House that's going to be there at one time. Members will be in their offices until they're needed. And then they start going through the states and verifying their counts. So, you know, for a lot of states, they will sail through, but there are states that we know Republicans will challenge. Arizona, early in the alphabet, should be the first one we hear from. The chambers then break up when there's a challenge and go to debate for up to 2 hours. So we expect this to go on for pretty long. There are six states that are ones that President Trump heavily contested. And we think, you know, if you, not too hard to do the math, if you're a member of Congress contesting six states, that's up to 12 hours of debate before things get confirmed. So Democrats, it's not clear whether they're going to push Republicans and say, okay, how long do you really want to draw this out, or try to wrap things up quickly? We know what the outcome is going to be. It's just how much political drama there will be in the meantime. And so we're in for a long night here, those of us covering this.
A lot of long nights these days, right?
That's right. 2021 is a continuation of that.
Yeah, right. Normally staunch supporters in Congress are defying Trump on this issue. The likes of, you know, Texas Republican John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn, you know, it's all up and down. And of course, opponents of his in the Republican Party, the few that there are defying him as well. What do you think their calculus is at this point?
There's a variety of reasons. There are a few Trump opponents in the GOP, as you said, I mean, a very few, but there are people who have aligned with him politically who have said, we need to move on from this. The reasons include things like, you know, Mitch McConnell is now the most powerful Republican in Washington, and that will remain the case even if he's not majority leader. And he has urged his caucus and his loyalists to accept this and move on. There are people who say that doing damage to the Electoral College, as this would do, is bad for Republicans. It's bad for people from small rural states whose influence is greater because of the Electoral College. Senator Tom Cotton, a very consistent Trump ally, made that case in saying that he would not vote with the dozen or so colleagues of his who will, you know, object to the election. So there's sort of a gamut here, but I think people see some political reality here. I mean, there's certainly the fact that people don't want to take it too far in terms of putting the democracy in jeopardy, but there's also practical benefits for these Republicans who are not going to be under the thumb of Trump as much anymore coming in about 2 weeks.
Right. Republican Representative Chip Roy of Texas forced a vote on whether to allow Speaker Nancy Pelosi to seat the House members in the states that Trump is challenging, these six states. The vote was 371-2 in favor of her. So how are they, what are they saying? I mean, how are they reconciling their support of one set of election statistics in the same states with their opposition to another set?
That's, you know, reconciling is a tough thing to do in that situation.
Maybe they're just not.
Questions, it gets tough to do. And especially when they come from someone who is a tried and true conservative, Chip Roy, who made that claim or made that argument, was the former chief of staff to Ted Cruz, who was leading the Senate caucus, who is objecting to the election. So that's a pretty telling example of the rift that you're seeing here. You know, the logical explanation you can't go too far with, and some of these people are saying, well, maybe the some of the people who are objecting say, we will object to this on the grounds that there needs to be a commission to study the election, basically wanting to further prolong things. But, yeah. You know, practically, not a lot of people who want to hear that President Trump is going to lose want to hear that. They only want to know that this is delaying the inevitable. So, you know, there's circles and circles of rhetorical arguments about this. But yeah, it is pretty tough to buy some of the conspiracy theories about the election that have been proven really baseless, and then also think that anybody who interfered with the presidential election didn't think it would behoove them to also interfere with congressional elections.
Right, exactly. All 10 living former defense secretaries wrote in a joint op-ed that the time for questioning has passed. And they leveled some pretty serious concern about what it does to the democracy to battle on this front. What are their concerns? I mean, why defense secretaries getting involved?
Because I think that they have some genuine concerns, and people who are actually President Trump's former defense secretaries were on that list. Mark Esper, who was there until up until after the election, and Trump's former defense secretary, Jim Mattis, was on that list. I think they saw the military being used in ways that they weren't comfortable with, like back in the protests in D.C. over the summer.
The Bible, Esper, that kind of a thing, the Bible?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the last formal step in the process of Trump not being president anymore after January 20th. This is what's in the law. The options available to him after that are getting into the really far-fetched, but I think the things that you have to at least be aware of, which is he's the commander in chief. Does he have some command over the military? These are people who are ostensibly highly respected within the military and have some experience and authority of that. And it seemed to me that they want to get ahead of any talk of that. Even just talk of things like using the military for this sort of thing is really dangerous from their perspective. And so you hear this group of former secretaries coming out in a way that sought, I think, to get ahead of any prospect that Trump's thing of last resort would be to use the military to stay in power.
Natalie Jennings, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Hope you can make it through the night okay.
Thank you so much. It's good to talk with you.
You bet. Natalie Jennings is the editor of The Fix. That's the Washington Post blog. I read it every day. It analyzes and explains the political stories of the day and the 5-Minute Fix newsletter. Coming up, more on the history and the trajectory of the process of the Electoral College. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. At the close of the controversial 1876 election that resulted in Republican Rutherford B. Hayes being declared the president-elect, a historian of the day wrote that he hoped Americans would never again be put to such a test. The Electoral Count Act came as a result of the conflict, and it is what will guide lawmakers today in the Electoral College certification process. Political scientist Robert Alexander is director of the Institute for Civics and Public Policy at Ohio Northern University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
And Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to talk to you.
And Ned Foley, professor of election and constitutional law at Ohio State. His 2020 book is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, The Rise, Demise, and Potential Restoration of the Jeffersonian Electoral College. Welcome back, Ned.
Hi, Ann. Good to be with you.
All right. So what happened, Ned, in the 1876 election to fuel a movement like that?
Oh, boy, we don't have time for the whole story.
It was the thumbnail.
But to cut to the chase, you know, this was during Reconstruction, and what was happening, there was a huge fight over the future of America, and particularly the South, with the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln and Ulysses Grant, wanting to be for civil rights and voting rights and keep federal control to protect freedom and equality. But the Redeemer movement in the South, really a white supremacist movement, was trying to take back state government. And it led to these rival claims in the states, Florida, South Carolina, Louisiana, of who controlled state government, essentially. And it affected the presidential election because you had different institutions of state government claiming to be authoritative in appointing presidential electors, or at least having the authority to count the popular vote. And so these rival submissions of electoral votes got sent to Congress, and Congress had to figure out, from Florida, for example, which package of votes was the real votes from Florida, because one claimed to be because signed by the governor and the other one claimed to be because it was signed by a different governor. So who's the governor? Which votes count? That was sort of what was going on back then.
And what kind of shadow does that cast, or what kind of light does it cast on the process today?
Well, for one thing, you know, Senator Cruz in particular is referring to this history as the precedent for why he is claiming that he wants to have a commission. They had a commission back then. They needed the commission, partly because the Senate and the House of Representatives and Congress were so divided between the Hayes side and the Tilden side. And you had to somehow get beyond that stalemate between the two parts of Congress to get an answer. You know, we don't have that situation today because the Senate as a body and the House as a body are going to be in agreement that Biden won and will get inaugurated. So you don't need a commission for that reason. But Senator Cruz is wrong in his understanding of the commission back then, because it wasn't designed to recalculate the popular vote in the states to figure out whether Hayes or Tilden got more ballots from citizens in Florida. That was not its purpose. Its purpose was just to figure out, again, which submission from Florida was the government's submission. And even on Hannity last night, Senator Cruz was saying that he wants his commission to do this audit of the popular vote to try to figure out whether there was fraud in Arizona or Georgia, these states. And the decisive decision of the commission itself for Hayes-Tilden said its job was not to look into fraud. That was for Florida to do. Its job was to simply figure out what was, you know, who Florida's electors actually were.
And I mean, Ted Cruz doesn't have the final say in what any kind of commission would do anyways. Right, Robert Alexander? I mean, Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman has proposed a bipartisan commission as a way to, as he puts it, restore faith in the election process. It's not clear what a commission would do anyways.
I'm not exactly clear what the commission would do, and I don't think that that's going to happen. Everything has been followed. To me, the big day was Safe Harbor Day. And that was kind of, if you were going to have drama, that's where the drama was going to be. And once that day passed, December 8th, I believe it was, when every single state certified their Electoral College vote, then we understood that at that point, the Electoral Count Act said that's when all of these kinds of issues should be handled. And so to have a commission at this point, it's not going to happen, at least as a result of to change this election or anything along those lines. There may be, I would be shocked if there's not going to be some study of voting across the country. It will certainly happen within states. I'm sure that there'll be new legislation examining things like early voting, things like no excuse absentee voting, drop boxes like we have in the state of Ohio. So those kinds of things will certainly come under scrutiny. And in some cases, they will become more accessible. And in some cases, I think that they might become less accessible. But the idea of a commission, as Professor Foley pointed out, really isn't the gold standard for trying to resolve electoral college disputes.
Yeah, I've covered a number of blue ribbon commissions in my day. And yeah. So, all right. So, Jeffrey Engel, what is this? Is this just a political ploy then? Or is this something that will go down in the history books, do you think, as damaging or fortifying in some way?
You know, actually, I think it's both. I think it's certainly for the moment a political ploy. I mean, as Robert mentioned, there's really no logical way that the Congress can, on the current legislation, refute the votes that are certified by the states. So this is political theater that is being played to President Trump's supporters, President Trump's base, and I think most importantly, being played to President Trump himself. I mean, clearly President Trump values loyalty among all things, loyalty even so far as going beyond what the actual facts represent. What he is concerned about is people's fealty to him, not necessarily to the truth. So this is theater to ensure that President Trump believes that people are doing all that they can for his side. And I think historians are going to look back on this not as a moment of peril, this today's vote, because the outcome is determined, but rather as a moment that signifies, that symbolizes the breakdown of trust in the electoral system. Now, hopefully, we'll be able to write that history and say this was a moment of distrust. I am wary that we have to write that history someday saying this is the moment when the trust broke down entirely.
Ned Foley, the president, tweeted famously now that the vice president has the power to reject if he finds fraudulently chosen electors. And you wrote in the Washington Post yesterday that any attempt by the vice president to intervene would be a constitutional travesty. So first of all, do we know what the president is talking about?
Well, he's not talking about anything that is permissible,
okay,
or that will be successful.
Or has ever been disputed.
Well, on that point, it's certainly never been accepted, but throughout the periods of the 19th century, partly for partisan reasons and including in the Hayes-Tilden fight, people sort of asserted this idea that maybe the president of the Senate, because that's who's designated by the Constitution to chair this joint session, the special joint session that'll take place today, that somehow that presiding officer can get to control the decision. That's a mistaken interpretation of the Constitution, and it's certainly not what the statute that was adopted after Hayes-Tilden wants. But there were lawyers for Rutherford Hayes at the time, including a former attorney general named William Maxwell Everts, who kind of pushed this idea in the hope that it could help the Hayes team, you know, prevail during that dispute. It was emphatically resisted by the Tilden forces, and again, it never prevailed either then or subsequently. You know, it's in the history books and it's now been trotted out again, but it won't be successful this year.
Well, yeah. Robert Alexander, what kind of damage does trotting stuff like this out do to, you know, the faith in the process?
But yeah, it's really interesting talking about restoring faith in the process when many of those that are raising these objections are creating the most doubt in the process. So that's the real irony of all of this. We've got an election that really isn't in dispute. Joe Biden's 7 million votes, you know, won the popular vote by 7 million. The distinctions in several of the swing states are actually more robust for Biden than they were for Trump 4 years ago in an election that Trump lost by 3 million votes across the country. So, I mean, it's fascinating, the irony here and the outrage that you have over questions of voter fraud and these types of things, particularly in a pandemic, when you know, states, and many of them were Republican controlled states, did take some steps to try and I don't know, make people safer and make the ballot accessible. And every single one of those, they've been adjudicated. The Trump team has not had hardly any success whatsoever, other than allowing election observers to have a little bit closer peek at the process. And apart from that, I mean, you know, they've whiffed in the courts. In many of those courts, they've been GOP appointed judges. So, you know, this question of faith in the electoral process, it predates Donald Trump. I should point that out. This is not just the Donald Trump thing. This is something that we've seen, you know, questions of this in the GOP for many years. So, you know, I think one thing that should be, we should be a little bit thankful for is that a lot of these election administrators in these swing states have been reputable and they have followed the book. And if they hadn't, I mean, if you look at some of the opportunism that we're seeing in Congress right now, you know, thankfully that hasn't existed among a lot of these election administrators.
There have been whiffs of calls for nationalizing the election process, taking it out of this, you know, out of the realm of state control. And I'm just wondering, Jeffrey Engel, is there any historical precedent for that, or is it?
No, I think on the contrary, the historical precedent has always been to ensure that the states have control. Now, obviously, right, there's been federal moves in the civil rights era and the Reconstruction era to ensure that voting was done equitably. But the bigger point, and I think the point that we need to remember that was constructed within the Constitution, is that this is a state issue. I mean, it's comical, hypocritical to the point of farce that conservatives such as Senator Cruz, who normally believe in local control and state control, are now suggesting that states are not qualified to make their own electoral decisions. Remember, the Congress is not there to determine whether or not the voting was done right. They're there to determine whether or not the states have given their votes. And it's really not a federal issue at all.
Well, and that's why I wonder about having a federal commission studying what the states did and the appropriateness of that, Ed Foley.
Yeah, so this goes back to the question of how much reform do we want to undertake in the aftermath of this difficult year. You and I have talked in the past, Anne, about, you know, getting rid of the Electoral College and having a whole new presidential election system. You know, I think that's a heavy lift given how hard it is to amend the Constitution. You know, if we had a true national presidential election, yeah, then you probably need a national election commission to count the votes and so forth. You know, I think Jeffrey Engel is absolutely correct that the Electoral College, whether we like it or not, is built on a state sovereignty philosophy and a state sovereignty structure. And, you know, with that comes, frankly, some questions about what power Congress actually would have even legislatively into the future. So, for example, you know, one of the things that came up this year with all of the litigation that Professor Alexander was talking about, you know, there was lawsuits filed in state court and federal court and all over the place and forum shopping. And it's like, which court is, you know, why do we need five lawsuits in Pennsylvania? Can't we just have one to settle this? So, you know, what if Congress tried to write a law that said all litigation over counting votes, that is the popular votes in a state in a presidential election, that litigation has to be in federal court, subject to rules of federal civil procedure that Congress adopts. I think you could make a conservative, small, you know, see conservative argument that that would be unconstitutional, because the Constitution gives states the power under Article 2 to determine the manner of appointing their electors. And so for Congress to step in and say, well, if you have a popular vote, you can only do it if you play by our congressional rules. You know, I would have thought conservatives would be outraged in that. And yet that is exactly the function that Senators Hawley and Cruz are giving to Congress to act in a quasi-judicial capacity today, that it would be probably unconstitutional in their view to give to an Article III federal court.
You know, I'm just interested. Well, I know that would require a constitutional amendment to change this, but I've said several times this morning already that this confirmation or the certification process that will, you know, convene, you know, or start at 1 o'clock today in a joint session is ceremonial. Why have it anyways? What is the purpose, Robert Alexander, of doing this in the first place? Since you've already had the December 8th, I can't remember what they call it today, but that's all done with. Why this?
Well, I think, and you're kind of getting to a couple of really important points, and one of them is just how complicated this process is and how long this process is and how convoluted this process is, which, you know, to me, one of the most important factors in any kind of democracy is that people understand the process. And if there's anything that we've seen in this election, and frankly, in the last several elections, is that most people don't understand the process. But the reality here is that it's set by the Constitution to be counted in front of this joint session of Congress. And so, you know, that's where it comes from. But these interpretations about what should or could happen are just wild. And it even goes back again to, you know, after it was clear that Biden won, about how some Republicans were floating ideas that state legislatures could just usurp power from the citizenry and select electors themselves. I mean, that kind of talk, frankly, and I'm not an alarmist. So whenever you start that and then you have the but, I'm not an alarmist, but that is an authoritarian type of move. To just say, we're just going to just dispatch what the people want, and we're going to do what we want. And then to have these kinds of objections that are raised. And, you know, Ben Sasse had a, I think it's probably pretty truthful statement when he said, in closed doors, none of my colleagues are crying that, you know, Donald Trump actually won the election, that there's a lot of fraud. And instead, he placed it at the hands of political opportunism. So, I mean, I think that's really what we're seeing much of today.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll get to your questions. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ned Foley, I have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for your time today, though. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Take care.
You too. Ned Foley, professor of election and constitutional law at Ohio State. His 2020 book is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, The Rise, Demise, and Potential Restoration of the Jeffersonian Electoral College. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Electoral College certification process, which takes place today. The normally ceremonial affair will be anything but this time. 13 senators and more than 100 House members, all Republicans, plan to object to state electoral results, at least the results in six states. Still with us, political scientist Robert Alexander, director of the Institute for Civics and Public Policy at Ohio Northern University, and Jeffrey Engel, the director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A question I meant to ask when Ned was around, but I certainly relevant to both of you. What if Vice President Pence doesn't show up today? And why are people even asking that question? Robert Alexander?
Well, at that point, I mean, Pence is obviously in an awkward situation. The President of the United States is tweeting out that he has the authority to reject fraudulent votes and whatnot, which he doesn't. But some question has been raised as to whether or not he were going to show up. And if he did not show up, then the president pro tem would then preside over the Senate, which would be Chuck Grassley. Okay. And it's fascinating because just the other day, Grassley said that he was going to be presiding in a tweet, I believe. So it went back and forth, but it does appear that Pence will be serving in that role. It has happened in the past where several awkward situations where vice presidents who were presiding over the Senate and who lost, had that ignominious role of,
Well, Joe Biden famously.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't lose, but
it appears that he will be there to hand those certificates over to the Senate tellers.
Yeah, I shouldn't say Joe Biden didn't lose in that case, but he was handing the reins over to, obviously, the Trump administration at that point. It was awkward. In fact, at that point, there have been other times besides 1876 and today when there have been objections raised to the electoral counts. There was a 2005 case when Ohio Representative Stephanie Tubb Jones and Senator Barbara Boxer of California, both Democrats, objected to Ohio's electoral votes, claiming irregularities. Jeffrey Engel, what has history taught us subsequent or since 1876 about these kinds of things? They tend not to take much time.
They tend not to take much time, and they tend to have very little effect. I mean, I think that there's a big distinction to be made between a 2005 case where one senator and one representative want to essentially offer a protest or at least an acknowledgement vote that there was something that should be looked into. And this, which is a concerted effort, ill-fated though it may be, a concerted effort to change the vote, to alter the result. And I really think Robert mentioned before that he doesn't like to be an alarmist, so I'll be an alarmist. This is a critical question of the way our Constitution is written. I mean, the complexity of the Electoral College is something I think that we can thank at this point for, well, I'm not a fan, by the way, but the complexity we can thank at this point for, at the very least, providing opportunity for multiple and numerous at several levels checks upon authority. You know, if we were had a purely federal election and we had the chief executive pressuring people who directly reported to him changing to change votes, well, that's exactly how authoritarian regimes hold power. And so the fact that we have a convoluted system at this point is actually, as the founders intended, keeping tyranny and keeping power from encroaching beyond its constitutional bounds.
Let's see, Mel in Columbiana County, you're on the air. Hi, Mel.
Hi, good morning. I got like a comment and a question.
Okay.
I don't really understand why we still use the Electoral College at all. Everything else is done by popular vote, and we have no problem with that. And as you would on the program earlier, Trump lost this election by 7 or 8 million, the last one by 3 million. And as far as I know, a Republican hasn't won an election since 1984 by popular vote. Why do we bother with it?
Okay, well, Jeffrey Engel, we'll start with you.
We bother it with it because that's the way the rules are set up. And that's actually what's so frustrating about what the Republicans and what President Trump are doing today in particular. It's one thing to critique the Electoral College, and I would love to go on for hours and hours and hours critiquing the Electoral College and talking about why it's a bad system, though I would parenthetically add that if you're really worried about the Electoral College system, you should be really, really worried about the undemocratic nature of the Senate. That occurs every day, whereas the Electoral College only comes into place every 4 years. So if you want to have that discussion, that's fine. But what's going on today is an effort to rebuke the rules as currently set. I mean, if Congress wanted to change the Constitution, wouldn't happen. But if Congress wanted to, they would establish the rules going forward, and we would expect people to follow the rules going forward. What's going on today is an attempt to subvert the rules as currently stated. And again, the President of the United States is charged in the Constitution with faithfully executing the laws. the laws at this point are very clear about how elections are run, convoluted though they may be. And what we see today is an effort not to follow and faithfully execute the laws, but actually to undermine them.
Robert?
Well, we actually, I mean, the Electoral College is kind of like a lingering injury that you just kind of deal with and just kind of limp along and power through. Most Americans really have not liked the Electoral College since its inception, and it's never really worked as it was intended to. It fell apart within the first decade. So the Electoral College, in fact, after the 1968 election, which is where there was the first objection lodged under the Electoral Count Act, to a faithless elector, there was serious debate about abolishing it. In fact, over 80% of House members, including George H.W. Bush, Gerald Ford, Republicans, they said, Richard Nixon also said, yeah, I prefer a popular vote. Donald Trump himself has said he'd prefer a popular vote. But in that election, or excuse me, in that debate, the House was fully on board with it. It was filibustered in the Senate, never went to a vote. At that time, over 80% of Americans, in fact, just a shade more Republicans, actually supported abolishing the Electoral College. Today, however, it's become a much more partisan issue. And, one's view of the Electoral College really depends upon where you stand in the Electoral College. So if you believe that you're benefiting from it, you support it a heck of a lot more. And if you think that it's working against you, you're not willing to support it. So I think we'll continue to see more arrows slung at the Electoral College, but it's the threshold to amend it, the Constitution to abolish it, is very, very high.
Right. Yeah. Jeffrey Engel.
Yeah. And just to reinforce Robert's point, we should remember that the very first resolution to amend the Constitution that was offered in the very first Congress was to amend the Electoral College, and that there have been more resolutions to amend the Electoral College than any other element of the Constitution in our history. This is something that has stunk from the beginning. But again, it's the rules. And as long as everybody agrees to play by the rules, we can kvetch. But I think we need to remember that rules are there for a reason. They are to be followed.
I think of the Electoral College and the efforts to upend it cyclically as they come along. Reminds me of efforts to change how we draw congressional and how state house districts and that kind of a thing. It depends on if you're going to benefit from the way the system is, or you think you perceive you will, then what's the motivation to change it for the betterment of all? There is none.
Exactly. And the way the system's set up now, of course, smaller states have greater power within the Electoral College. And those same smaller states are the ones whose congressional delegations and then legislatures would have to agree to amend the Constitution to reduce their own power. So cite for me the number of times in history, not just American history, but global history, where people have actively voted to take power away from themselves. Very few. So I think we're unlikely to see any change on this front.
Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hey there. So my solution is the first debate for the presidency should always be kind of like a citizenship test. They should be asked very specific questions. Do you understand our history? Do you understand the Constitution? I think that would eliminate a lot of fear going on.
Well, I would go a little deeper and say, I wouldn't say that's a yes or no answer then. But I get your point, Fred. Civics 101. It's an interesting idea, but Jeffrey Engel and Robert Alexander. I mean, you the convolutedness of this. Yeah, every 4 years I'm having this conversation now, and for people who oppose the electoral process as it stands now, because it favored this time Joe Biden, should remember that if we had gone with a popular vote 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton would have been president. Period.
I'm all for civic literacy. I think that we really need to invest in our civic and critical thinking infrastructure. We have not done that, and we're seeing some of the problems that go along with that. But coming back to that point on the Electoral College, frankly, as you've seen Georgia and the results from Georgia come in, which is a bit surprising to many folks. Jeffrey's state there in Texas, if Texas continues to kind of move toward the Democrats, then Democrats could lock up Electoral College victories pretty easily, given where their strength is. And they may come to love the Electoral College, and Republicans may come to loathe the Electoral College. So again, that, where you stand really determines how you see the benefits or the pitfalls of that system.
614-292-8513. We have a few minutes left if you want to get a quick question in. As far as the trust in the election process and the Electoral College system, I mean, there's a lot, you know, I think the convolutedness of it makes it so that there's lots of bits and pieces out there that people have problems with. I think probably all three of us were raised in a world where we thought we had the best system in the universe until we didn't. And you're historians, so you see the breakdowns and study the history of it. But just from a popular contemporary point of view, where do you think this breakdown started, Jeffrey Engel?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's cyclical. I think that we have to remember that there was concerns about the sustainability of the government multiple times in our history. The most recently, I think, as an existential crisis would be during the Great Depression, that people wondered whether or not the system was so fundamentally broken that we needed a new constitution or a new form of government, or in some senses, people were arguing a new type of government, perhaps more authoritarian. So it's nothing new in American history to have people distrust the way the system is set up. What is different about this moment is that we've never before in our history had a president of the United States undermine confidence in the democratic process and undermine confidence in the very notion of democracy itself, and undermine people's faith that the government is competent to count. And the different states are competent to count. So this is really important because, you know, this is in essence the president of the United States arguing that we need to throw out the Constitution that he has sworn to protect and defend. Let's pause on that moment and realize the magnitude of exactly what the Republican objections are today. It is to not disrupt the vote. It is to delegitimize the notion of the democratic process writ large. And frankly, I find that very troubling.
Yeah, Robert?
Well, it's fascinating. Last night, I was going through, like everybody's doing, the C-SPAN objection to the vote in Ohio. And Tom DeLay, a Republican, was answering the objection and basically trying to discount what the Democrats' claim was.
This was in 2005, yeah.
This is in 2005, yeah. And Ohio was the disputed state, and it mattered because without Ohio, George W. Bush wouldn't have won. Interestingly, had he lost Ohio, he would have won the popular vote by 3 million, but lost in the Electoral College, and he barely won the state of Ohio. But DeLay, in his argument there in the House, he said, he likened the Democrats to kind of using an X-Files narrative. That George W. Bush was a computer nerd who could change the ballot system in the state of Ohio, and they're relying upon wild conspiracy theories. Boy, doesn't that sound familiar? But in that case, it was coming from individuals within the Democratic Party. In this case, as Professor Engel points out, this is coming from the President of the United States, and now it's amplified through social media channels, which I think is just dropping thoughts in the minds of people left and right. And we are basically just creating that system. These little cocoons where we don't have to pay attention to anything that is dissonant to those views.
Yeah, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth as far as the social media piece of this. It wasn't envisioned by the founders, right, Jeffrey Engel?
No, I think George Washington did not contemplate tweeting, but the way that the system is currently structured, because of social media, of course, and because of, as Professor Alexander said, the siloing of the American electorate, what we have is a fascinating case study where individuals, the president most especially, can make farcical claims and then claim that they need to have an investigation to prove their farcical claims right or wrong. You know, it would be akin to my saying, you know, I'm 14 feet tall. By the way, I'm not. But if I said I'm 14 feet tall, if I say it enough times, people are going to say, well, maybe we should have an investigation to find out whether or not he's 14 feet tall. It doesn't stop the fact that the initial statement was farcical. And the fact that every federal and state judge that has looked at these claims by the president and his supporters and throw them out purely for lack of evidence, not just because that they are wrong on the law, but because there are no facts to support the contention by the president and his side. That should give anyone who is wondering at this moment which side to back, give them a good indication that if the federal judges, many of whom are appointed by President Trump, are saying that there is simply no reality here, that should tell you what reality is.
Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
And good to talk to you.
You bet. And Robert Alexander teaches political science at Ohio Northern University, where he is founding director of the Institute for Civics and Public Policy. Robert Alexander, thanks so much for your time as well today.
Such an honor, Ann.
Thanks. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MPR News.